This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
As we normally do on a Tuesday, we focus on an academic paper. And today we're in conversation with Ofentse Mokoena, who's a transport economist as well as a scholar who has looked into the public transport system in relation to universities and how the public transport system should also be responsive to the behavior of university students. I'd like to hear from you. If you are still in university, if you've been in university, what was your experience like using the public transport system? Are there any issues that you've came across and that you feel that probably, you know, there should be some tighter controls probably here? Here are some innovative ideas that you think that the transport department could integrate and have as part of its scholar transport policy. So 0861987000. You can also tweet at Aldrin Simpia, hashtag PowerTalk, and also tweet at PowerFM987. Ofentse, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you to your listeners also.
Yeah, siyabonga kakhulu. Quickly tell us about what is it about this particular topic that interested you?
To put it simply, when I started, the whole idea was to show that we're probably not looking at transport issues from the right perspective. Well, that's what I thought at first, largely because it was all about money, it was all about class, and I thought, well, students are different. They get allowances. They probably develop some kind of preference for a transport mode from somewhere. Mm. And it might be interesting to look at the problem in a way that actually involves some kind of behavioral theory rather than just looking at, you know, people's incomes and so on. So that was really the whole idea. But what actually motivated me to do the study was when I broke my bicycle, so I had to start, you know, commuting to work more often.
Yeah.
And I started realizing that you know, the plight of the student market is quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. And with you cycling from, was it cycling from home or was it cycling from the res?
It was actually from home. This was during my working life.
Okay.
So I would cycle to work. I think it was the first 2 years of work, I was recycling work. And then, but just before I bought the bike, I was basically walking about, I think it was about like almost an hour or so, but I got faster. So I'd walk an hour to the taxi rank in town, then catch a taxi, you know, and I just kept on thinking about that. Mm-hmm. This was just in my working life alone.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Okay, and then in terms of behavior, before we get into the research and some of your findings, in terms of behavior, what are some of the aspects then that you think informs behavior, and also the distinction, for instance, the distinction that you make that student behavior versus ordinary public behavior in relation to public transport?
Yeah, so I think we can start off by drawing the line between what people prefer and what people choose.
Okay.
So you know, everyone has some kind of preference. Preferences are usually things that you would almost like to do if you had all the resources that you would like to have if you could. And choice is something else. Choice is basically something that you do within the constraints that you have. So if, for example, you want to go from, let's say, where you are right now in studio, and you want to go to the nearest restaurant so that you can have a meal, you'd prefer having a meal from a specific restaurant. You know, that's your preference, but you can't do that. You know, that choice is not in your set of options at the moment because we're in a lockdown situation. So, but now, so that's the basis. The next layer was to find, like, you know, the kind of things that, that individuals use to help them navigate through making decisions. And that's where the complexity comes in, you know, like, and the funny thing about people is that we don't really think about our choices or preferences, you know, deliberately. It's actually something that's built up from habit. It's something that you're used to. It is something that is a byproduct of maybe the people you're around, the norms in society, or the things that you think you cannot do, you know, so attitudinal limits that you have, you know, with regard to a certain behavior. So those are the kind of things that, that influence the whole thinking behind, you know, how people actually make choices or structure their choices. And then, of course, that's based on their preferences.
Okay, so then we can also then say that the behavior itself is also influenced, for instance, with universities, influenced by the timetable, right? With the work scenario would be saying that it's influenced by company deciding that in terms of the working hours, we say that we open at 9 and we close at 5.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that. So this is to the second part of your question, right? So students, much of the evidence around the world highlights that students' travel behavior is quite distinct from the general public. And when we do traffic models, which is what we use to plan for cities, to plan transport networks, the practice is to almost aggregate or put everybody into an average and then assume that people are just going to make trips all the time. And then you have a normal peak. So you've got a peak in the morning and a peak in the evening. But with the student community, the peak is almost spread across the entire day. You know, there are some significant peaks in the mornings and in the afternoons, of course, because that's when most people come in and that's when most people leave. But there are also these peaks that are spread across different routes. It could be that vary by area. And yes, they are based on the timetable, but they're also based on how students operate in general. You know, they're sort of going to class is not necessarily compulsory, you know. So the activities are distributed in a way that's quite interesting, especially given the digital environment that we're in right now. So students anywhere around the world, whether you're in Beirut, whether you're in the US, they tend to be a very different type of group. Even if they're using cars, cycling, or public transport, they tend to have, in fact, a higher value of time than the average person in society, which is quite fascinating because they don't earn a lot of money.
Okay, so 0861987000, we're in conversation with Ofentse Mokoena, focusing on his dissertation, looking into university student travel behavior. And this is in context to universities in South Africa. And I think one of the other important aspects, Ofentse, that you highlight is also the reliance on private transportation, which would mean that somebody who owns their own car, for instance, but also how that could have been influenced by what happened during school. Like during school, while you're still going to school, secondary, for instance, that your parents would have been taking you to school.
That was something that I thought about because, you know, when you're riding your bike, you know, people look at you funny and whatever, especially when you're an adult.
especially in SA. And I'm like, guys, you know, in Europe, people are like cycling there with suits on and, you know,
You know, it's very weird. So when you're riding your bike, people do respond in a certain kind of way. But then it usually has to do with whether they've ridden a bike before. It's the same thing with, you know, primary school and high school travel experiences tend to influence how you're going to think about a specific transport mode. But then when you get to university, universities are planets on their own, you know, largely because some of them are closed off. So you've got a closed campus. Others are embedded in the city or the town. So they're open to the broader society. And that will also influence how people want to commute around and in between university sites, campuses, and activities. And it also depends, for example, on, you know, how much is happening around the university itself. So to get to your question, you know, what's quite clear in the literature is that there is evidence that highlights that if as a child you have something called a broader spatial cognizance, which means you commuted by yourself, or you made the journeys independently over a period of time, and then you develop some kind of spatial understanding of where you are and who you are in society, mm-hmm. which is quite interesting, right? And then on the other hand, if you are what they call bubble wrapped, which means you're sort of, you know, being transported to and from school mm-hmm. in a private car, then you also have a different type of experience of the world where it's relatively closed off,
yeah.
And your spatial awareness can be limited. Mm-hmm. So it's quite interesting.
Okay. And then let's get on to the National Learner Transport Policy. And first, the definition yeah. of it and what it exactly is and how it responds to school children, especially using public transportation. And why your argument is that university students' use and behavior of in relation to public transport should also be integrated into the transport, into the National Learner Transport Policy.
Yeah, so I don't know where to start. So let me start by saying that when you look at the Learner Transport Policy, its primary aim is to meet the mobility needs of learners through the provision of safe, you know, secure, reliable, and affordable learner transport services to support the social development and enhance, you know, future economic growth. And that's embedded, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, on top of that, you've got a constitutional element, which is, you know, access to education. You know, you've got the right to access, you know, education.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got another hierarchical element, right, which is basically that you have so many different types of education that people need to access, you know, whether it ranges from primary school, secondary school, that's basic education. But the more complex, you know, basket ranges from your TVET colleges, any post-school education center. And I've always been asking myself, you know, what are we doing for these groups? Because it's very easy for us to share, you know, resources with young children and say, okay, we're providing, you know, transportation services for children.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But the moment someone, you know, turns 18, they're saying, okay, they're adults, they can, you know, move around. And that assumption in many ways sort of distorts the nature of access to education, because these young people still rely on their parents. They still rely mm-hmm. on their guardians, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that was really the basis. And I looked at what's happening around the world. And around the world, the practice is that, you know, university mobility is actually embedded in the higher education institutions, but it's also embedded in either the local or regional departments of transport, or it is embedded in the provincial or regional higher education mm-hmm. Education departments.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the debate is in the South African context.
Where are we sitting in the South African context then?
I managed to look at, so in the thesis, I looked at about 6 of the 26 public universities.
Yes.
But then I did some, you know, as you progress with the work, you sort of do more.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up finding about seven higher education institutions that are actually trying to mm-hmm. respond to the mobility needs of university students. And they've introduced all kinds of measures,
yeah.
you know, so some of them have...
Just before you get to what those universities have introduced, so does this then mean that what we are seeing here in the South African context, and the example that you just made about what's happening internationally, is that in the South African context, it's not really a regional response, but it's rather a university-specific response?
Yeah, it is. It's an institutional response.
Yeah.
And actually, what's interesting is, so different universities have a different ideology about what they should do, you know.
Mm.
So the ones that I did observe are ones that have made direct interventions. Others make, for instance, indirect interventions, or they leave it to the market, whether, you know, yeah, to just let it go and say, well, let the market deal with that. That's not the responsibility of the higher education institutions. But I've been seeing some departments, you know, actually, I think it's in the Western Cape,
yeah.
starting to channel some contracts toward this direction where they're providing or encouraging the provision of university student transport. So it ranges between connecting campuses all the way to being a general transport service that is embedded in the traditional local transport service that exists, whether it's scheduled bus or pub or minibus taxis. But the minibus taxi cases is hasn't necessarily been achieved at scale yet. But generally, you know, that's the range of
So then it is, can we also argue that on the basis of, for instance, if you look at what happened with Fees Must Fall and how universities, individual institutions had specific individual responses to Fees Must Fall. And the argument from some of the activists was that, you have the management of the university, and they are allowed to come up with all the rules that they want to come up with, but there's no standardized approach, although we are dealing with a South African student, which could be in any province at any given time.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. And I think it is largely for the higher education professional to, you know, navigate through the kind of decisions that higher education actually make. Mm-hmm. From the transport perspective, you know, what we see from the Fees Must Fall was actually the byproduct of the fee-free, you know, education policy, you know, which aims to, it's almost a package of interventions. And these interventions involve in, you know, introducing public-private partnerships for student housing, you know, capping fees. And then there's also the NFSUS structure that also involves not only just cash for accommodation, foodstuffs, but also transport, you know. And this is where the big and very complicated debate is probably going to be, but it hasn't come to the fore yet. And you're probably right that everyone is going to have their own response to that, you know. But what's challenging is whether there is a need for a standard position similar and or equivalent to the learner transport policy, if not its extension. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of policy debate that is quite necessary.
And what does the learner transport policy tells us about how government responded in specific to learners, kids who are going to schools? We're going to touch on the universities when we come back from Power News Headlines. But just on this particular one, what does the policy tell us about government's intervention when it comes to kids?
So for young children, it's an age-specific, you know, intervention. It's also distance-specific, and in some cases, it can be school or district-specific. But the interventions are quite direct. They are quite standardized, right? But they go through. It's like a household by household criteria. Mm-hmm. But then it also has a value chain component where the prerequisite for example, providing bicycles, also involves providing maintenance, and that is a job creation activity as well. Yeah. But then the big challenge with that your Kubeka bikes identified is that when you do distribute a bicycle to one child, and find that the family actually needs the bicycle to bring in more cash, the family might use the bicycle. Then we move it up another level. If you do give one child a bicycle and others don't get a bicycle, then it creates a whole other situation. So you have to do an entire coverage.
Yeah.
Then the motorized side is where you have these bus contracts, which are learner transport contracts, really. And they are usually governed and administered by municipalities that are responsible, or largely provinces. But that comes at a very complex political cost, because Equal Education had to fight, you know, the province of KwaZulu-Natal to ensure that learners have scholar transport, and only recently did they publish a scholar transport policy. Okay. So there are real discrepancies, but the policy position is actually there.
Okay, so there is a blueprint that's there. So when we come back, we're going to look at how the 6 or 7 universities that you've looked into, how they've responded. And I wonder, people who are in universities that really don't have any transport system that is connected to the university at all. What has your experience been like? You can call us on 0861-987-000. Your tweet at Aldrin St. Pierre, hashtag Power Talking. You can also tweet at Power FM 987.
Aldrin St. Pierre, weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Power 98.7.
We're in conversation with Ofence Mokoena, transport economist and scholar. We're focusing on his dissertation around university student travel behavior, research focusing on what's happening at universities in South Africa and how the universities are responding to the transport needs of their students. But can we elevate it a bit and get national involved so that we have a standardized approach and we also have a blueprint around what is expected of universities, and it's not left up to the university management to decide how it will be responding to the individual needs, because you have different groups of children coming from different backgrounds, how the university is responding instead of having a standardized approach. So 0861-987-000, I'd love to hear from you, your personal experience as well, using public transport and while being a student. You can also tweet at Aldrin St. Pierre, hashtag Power Talk, and also tweet at Power FM 987. Professor Khumalo says that can we begin thinking about the environmental impact of vehicle ownership and how a bus system might assist in reducing carbon emissions. While universities don't think about from this perspective, it does have these outcomes or benefits. Ofence, I think you'd agree with that, eh?
Well, you know, there's a lot of work that shows how universities or university precincts can be these areas where you do reduce the carbon footprint. But let's take it one step further. You know, while you could have either a dedicated service or you can have an integrated service. So some of the literature shows us that if you lean more on including some kind of university-based pricing that attracts students to using more public transport or to cycle or what have you, that is part of the local transport network in terms of transport planning, what that does is it actually increases the load factors for the vehicles that are being used in the area. It makes the service more frequent because now there are more people using it.
Yes.
And it actually, for cycling and walking, it creates a much safer environment. In fact, it places more pressure for municipalities to say, listen, we need more bike lanes, we need more sidewalks, largely because people are moving around like this. And it won't affect students only. It has an entire network effect for anyone and everyone who's using transport in the area. So, yes, it has massive effects.
So is it about creating a tangible demand?
It's actually about, on one hand, there is an existing demand.
Okay.
Right? But then you almost have to induce it in such a way that it is part of the existing market, the way the existing services actually operate, and introducing new services in addition to that. And by services, I don't mean operators, vehicles, etc. It might just mean introducing an information platform. Mm-hmm. You know, it might just mean introducing a different pricing regime.
Yes.
It might just mean integrating your student card with a payment solution that is basically subsidized in some way or another.
With the BRT system in the city of Joburg, in the city of Joburg region, how does it work?
Yeah. Well, what I've seen with the Rea Vaya service is that they do have it's almost like getting, you know, when you get on, you almost have to, you can purchase your ticket, you know, and have a student price, just like even with city council buses, you can have a student price, but that's on confirmation. Because remember, once you're after 18, you can be a student anytime, you know. So there's that element you know, that we have to account for as well. So it's very interesting, but it's usually viable for learners rather than adults.
Okay.
You know, so
even though they are students.
Even though they're students.
Okay. Gift, good morning.
Morning, how are you?
Good, man.
Good. I want to ask that, did he look at how much time on average does a student spend on the road traveling to and from where they reside? Because I studied and I used to spend something like 4 hours to and from campus on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
So on average, did he check on as to how much time do we spend, how much time do students spend on the road per day?
Yeah. Okay. Offense?
That's a good question. And what it highlights, for example, is that when you look at the travel time for students, if you're on campus, off campus, or beyond, right, it is that where you live is dependent on how much you can afford in terms of accommodation, right? Then on top of that, you have the network effect around the transportation environment in your area. So the challenge for that is, if students are living on the outskirts, should they have a dedicated service, or should we improve the average service in the area?
That's
the kind of discussion that's quite key. So that's one of the reasons why intervention is not necessarily the responsibility of higher education institutions, but it's also not independent. They're not necessarily outside of, you know, trying to make or encourage or advocate for certain interventions either. So that's a profound question.
Yeah. Okay. And let's look at those 6-7 universities that you looked at and what their responses have been.
Okay. So when we look at the universities that I did look at, these interventions are more within the proximity of the university. So it's something like about, you know, 5 to 8 kilometers within the university, you know, catchment. So they're not large scale, you know, interventions. And these are South African interventions.
Yep.
So ranging from the University of Cape Town to Wits to Pretoria, KZN, Stellenbosch, Nelson Mandela University and Northwest University.
Mm-hmm.
And what's quite interesting is that many of the campuses, many of the universities with multiple campuses want to provide services that enable inter-campus mobility. So you should be able to move between different campuses. And you see that at UKZN. And you can also see that at the University of Pretoria as well.
Yeah.
But then you can also have these inter-resident services where if you're separated, you know, if the campus residences are, you know, scattered all over the place, then they try to provide these kinds of services. But the interesting part is that you've got other universities that are introducing, you know, things that are, or interventions that are more about, okay, if you guys are using your cars, then it might be ideal if you carpool, so share the vehicle.
Yeah.
And you know.
Is that UCT?
That's the UCT case. And then you have at UP, or University of Pretoria, where they piloted a bike sharing scheme recently, where basically students were part of this pilot project that enabled them to hire bicycles so that they can ride around. And some students actually used the bike sharing solution to start a business around delivering, you know, foodstuffs and other things, you know, using these bicycle transport modes. So interventions are so very various. But the key that I found quite interesting was the extent to which these universities have a mobility and access plan. So, you know, many universities have universal accessibility plans, which means if you have a disability of some sort, there is a plan that outlines how you can move around the university precinct. But in terms of mobility and access for the university community, which is students, the general public, staff, and the likes, you know, they also need to be part of some kind of mobility and access plan, and many universities don't have that. As far as I know, the only one that I saw was from the University of Stellenbosch. Others have bus services. Stellenbosch and UCT have a minibus taxi type shuttle, and then you've got UCT, which has a direct contracted bus service for the university, the Jammy shuttle.
Yeah.
And then you've got UKZN that also has something similar. Stellenbosch as well has something similar. And NMMU also has something similar. And that's largely due to context. But then the next question will have to be, should these services be embedded in the existing public transport network? You know, so many of them don't accommodate the general public.
Yeah.
So if you're not a student or a staff member, you can't ride the bus, which probably means that the bus might be running full in the mornings and maybe in the afternoons or somewhere in the middle of the day, throughout the day. But then the load factor could probably be much lower. Wow. And that's a bit problematic operationally. So you've got a lot of empty seats, and you're covering places and locations that other people might want to catch and ride with.
That's quite interesting, because now thinking about it, like if you have a bus, so let's say Starbus, which is just parked there during the day, that is from around, let's say around 10 o'clock until probably around 1 o'clock, those are empty seats and you're not making any money out of that yet. Yet you are paying for a full service, right?
Is it
then possible to integrate it, to let the public also use that transportation, but the bus service itself being commissioned by the institution?
Well,
and the institution also gets money from the bus service rendering a service to the public.
Well, there are some interesting examples, and these examples actually don't involve the institution alone.
Okay.
It's usually these, collaborations. So one example is in Iowa, in the U.S., where you've got the Student Representative Council, the municipality, so the transport authority in the area, and you've got the institution all collaborating to have a student-run bus transport service that is, open not just to students, but, during certain periods, the general public can also use it. On condition that you have a specific type of card. And that brings in a lot of, it basically pays for itself, and every year students cycle around inside that business. So it becomes a whole thing in and of itself. Then you have interventions like the the Brungo, which is basically it's the university and the municipalities coming together to introduce networks or routes that are closer to how students move around, in addition to the existing public transport network. But then on those specific buses painted blue, you have a tap, like a tap system that, so the general public can use the bus cash or what have you. Students use it through a tap system, and then the revenues from there are, or the cost of the students' mobility tends to be subsidized. Or it's paid for on an annual basis by the students, and you can opt in or opt out for that particular kind of engagement. And then they extend that entire program to the bicycle sharing schemes. They extend it to the car sharing schemes and so on. So there are a range of options.
Yeah.
And hence it's so important to have an actual plan, to actually know more or less what you need to do for the student community, which is staff, general public.
I think it's a fascinating idea that you have there. Because then it says that as the university itself, you won't have as much pressure, as much pressure in terms of subsidizing students who would be using public transport. And number two, the point that you also raise, as per the commission into the feasibility of free higher education, is that the commission says that the commission said no, free higher education cannot happen. However, though, it does make some proposals in terms of what interventions there should be to ensure that we have more students moving into higher education, which means that you'll have more students in higher education. Right now, the big debate is around accommodation. That's currently happening. And the next phase, the next wave, is going to be transport.
Yes. Actually, it's almost like you read my mind, because that's the exact phrasing I used in the summary of this report. And that's to say that the immediate, the lower hanging fruit was fees. And okay, now the fees is done.
Yeah.
It's accommodation. And once accommodation is done, then it's mobility and access, and those three are all in one basket, and it creates, in many ways, it's a very controversial topic in some circles, but then in other ways, it can also be a very liberating topic of discussion, especially for towns, university towns, that probably need, you know, integrated mm-hmm. transportation systems. So universities can play a crucial role in that, but they cannot do it alone. Mm-hmm. And actually, we take it one step further. The controversy can come from the tensions in the area in and of itself. You know, so the local taxi operators, the bus operators, you know, and everybody involved can get into a really tense kind of environment, you know, largely because there is no statutory position that says this is what needs to be done in at least in one document. Right now, everyone is fishing from different documents, mm-hmm. but it's specifically enabling mobility and access for students is going to be an interesting debate.
Okay, just quickly touch on the America's unlimited access model before we go to the power line.
Oh, okay. So the unlimited access model is exactly what I highlighted with the Bungo example. Mm-hmm. So what unlimited access basically argues for is that, hey, open up the existing public transport network for students, right? Create an access pass, have them ride as much as possible. It can range from free, so it can be free service, all the way to subsidized, all the way to full cost coverage. Mm-hmm. And students will have this option whether they opt in or opt out. But when you register, you automatically opt in, mm-hmm. you know, to that. And it's not cash that you can actually get back. So whether you use it or not, you know, it's just embedded inside the system. But here's the thing with the unlimited access platform is that it applies for staff, it applies for students, and it's embedded in the existing transport networks. Actually, it forced many transport networks to become more integrated, and also it distributed students and staff all over the university environment. So instead of paying high premiums very, very close in terms of accommodation, high premiums close to the institutions, people could live a little bit further away and still be able to commute to and from the university. And many of these buses have, you know, bicycle racks so that you can cycle from wherever you are, which increases your catchment, and catch a bus and still be able to park your bicycle on the bus.
What's the crime rack?
The crime in those settings is quite limited, and it's largely because they have a distributed network of security services. Mm. So universities that have closed campuses have security for the campuses.
Okay.
Universities that have open campuses have a distributed security service, which is spread all over the area where university students tend to, you know, be active in. So it's a subtopic in and of itself, but that is one of the key elements that make such interventions work. Yeah.
Eric, good morning.
Hey, good morning, your guest. Mm. Just a question, what's the comment of your guest in terms of, you know, this SMME business is provided by township operators where they transport school kids to middle seas. Is it viable? Is it something he has looked at in his model?
Just repeat that, Eric.
Yeah, I'm trying to check what's the comment of your guest in terms of these transporters of scholar transport from townships to Model C schools in the urban areas. What's his comment in his model? Is it something viable?
Is it
something good that one can look at or continue with?
As a business,
provided by SMMEs. Is it something that he has looked at in his model?
Okay, so this paper focuses on the universities, but Ofense, as a transport economist, I'm sure you can delve into that as well.
Yeah, I think Eric's question is, I started writing something yesterday about how, you know, the scholar transport operators, especially ones that do provide services, and only for learners, you know, my big question was, you know, are they going to survive this pandemic? Because children aren't going to school and parents won't pay you if you're not transporting, you know. So just to respond quickly, the big catch with that market, especially for operators that are not embedded or part of, you know, the ranking taxis. You know, these operators basically run their day-to-day business is to transport children, you know. And that segment is a very vastly neglected part of the learner transport environment. I'm not talking about the bus operators that can win tenders and contracts,
yes.
or the small bus operators that compete for contracts. I'm talking about these individuals who basically have had taxis. Maybe they used to rank and file. Now they're part of a clique, and they're saying, you know what, I can provide services for learners.
Yeah,
it's a good opportunity on one hand, but on the other hand, it does come with some risks. You know, there
Which are
some dynamic issues. For example, coordinating the subscription, right? For example, in the township context, sometimes some parents don't make the payment, right? And there's no way for you to basically be like, you didn't pay me this month, you didn't pay me the last month, you know. What are you going to do? Are you going to say the kid doesn't go to school anymore? You know, that's a predicament that many of the operators are faced with. But it's part and parcel of the origins of the taxi industry, which was a community service.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, I think much of our policies haven't really reflected on that element.
Okay. So in closing, some of your recommendations and limitations as well.
Well, so the study itself was difficult to do empirically. So one of the main limitations was basically the size of the sample and improving the quality of the modeling. That's something that I'm personally interested in.
Okay.
And then from a policy perspective, my primary recommendation is that, the lowest hanging fruit is that any transport planning entity or someone involved in transport planning should really think of this group of post-school education, you know, commuters. And they are a neglected segment in many respects, but they're also a valuable segment in many respects. And higher education institutions, municipalities, and the general public have a profound role to play in making sure that efficient and effective transport is available for them.
If you were to be asked for a proposal in terms of a system that the government can pilot, what would that system look like?
For student mobility?
Yes.
Oh, the first and foremost, there'll be two things. The one is basically push bike lanes, push bicycle infrastructure for these precincts. The second one is invest heavily in providing dedicated corridors for public transport. Once you do that, you know, everyone is just going to move completely, especially in the university towns, especially around university precincts. That's the ticket. That's the real ticket.
Okay. Yeah. No, thank you so much. Fensa Mugwena there.
Thank you so much, man.
Transport economist and scholar. Yes, and the podcast will be available. Just listening to Fensa there, I'm like, eish, you know, business ideas are just, they're just flowing. They're just flowing. And it's so fascinating speaking to people who then go and do research on something that they've come across. So this is something from their experience and then thought, actually, let me look into this. And now it could actually be a policy response. Beautiful. Love your work.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.